Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, April 30th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio just north of New York City. We're at the end of the strangest month that we've ever known. What do you think, Taylor?
It's bizarre. I was talking to my friends about this the other day. Like, it's completely melted away. And it was interesting, like the first, you know, probably 2 weeks of this whole self-isolating bit, it was really dragging on. And I feel like since then, the weeks have accelerated and time is moving a little bit more quickly, which is nice. Looking forward to June. June could be a good month, everyone. We got to get through May still.
Yeah, we got to get through May. But, you know, hoping we got rain up here in the Northeast today. It's supposed to be a beautiful weekend, so we're looking forward to that. And we're excited today for a conversation with writer Bill James, who changed baseball with his analytics, and he'll tell us the team he believes was ahead of the curve in using statistics before the Oakland Athletics. And we'll be talking with Kylie McDaniel about his new book, Future Value. But first, some notes. Yadier Molina is now open to a new team if the Cardinals aren't an option. He told that to our Marley Rivera. His quote was, "I previously said that if I wasn't with St. Louis, that I would go home. If we were unable to come to an extension agreement, that I would retire. But the situation with this pandemic has changed everything. Right now, I'm thinking of playing two more years. His contract is set to expire at the end of this year." The Tampa Bay Rays reportedly plan to furlough some full-time staffers. They're the first major league team known to plan furloughs of those full-time employees, and some of those will take effect this Saturday, according to the Associated Press and the Tampa Bay Times. The Baseball Hall of Fame made it official. They postponed their July induction ceremony until 2021. Minor League Baseball said on Wednesday night that reports circulating tonight that the 2020 Minor League Baseball season has been canceled is false. Minor League Baseball has confirmed with Major League Baseball that no such statement was made. No decision has been made as to when it will be safe to begin the 2020 season. I have some thoughts on that. And before we get to Bill and to Kylie, check out the latest episode of the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. In today's episode, Mina and Sam Monson of Pro Football Focus discuss the team drafts they like the most, the Packers trading up for Jordan Love, the Eagles taking Jalen Hurts, and Jameis Winston landing in New Orleans. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Bill James's work has had a huge impact in baseball. He served as a crossroad to take to the game to where we are now with the use of analytics in front offices. And as we talked about on the show earlier this week, someday he should be given the Buck O'Neill Award for Lifetime Achievement in Baseball. Bill, as I was getting ready for this, I saw so many different descriptions for you, titles, statisticians, historian. And I was curious, what title would you apply for yourself if you were writing those?
I have studiously avoided applying any title to myself because I'm not really qualified for most of them. And I just, when I have to describe myself, I describe myself as a writer because that's the vaguest and most general term. And there appear to be no qualifications at all to describe yourself as a writer. So I'm comfortable with that one.
That's funny because I sometimes when I get introduced on radio shows, they'll say ESPN personality, and that'll make me cringe. And I don't really feel like I'm a TV person because I start out in newspaper. So that's the one I always settle for, too, is writer. You're right. That's a nice, comfortable one. So I just in getting ready for this, one of the questions I had for you as you started writing about baseball and your work began to be noticed, what was the first time that a team reached out to you about your research?
The first contacts I had with teams actually were on the other side of the table. The people working for player agents reached out to me very early in my career, I guess 1978, and I worked in salary arbitration cases in the 78-79 season and then more after that. The first time I came in contact with organizations in kind of professional capacity was I was on the other side of the arbitration case. The first time they were interested in hiring me was, well, I did some work for a team about maybe 1983, very early. I did a special project had to do with moving fences. And the first time an organization offered to hire me was sometime in the 1990s, but it wasn't the right opportunity.
You mentioned the arbitration case. What were the first arbitration cases that you worked on? And at that time, how was your work received in those discussions?
It was a really good experience for me at the beginning. I think the very first case that I was involved in presenting was Denny Walling. And I'm an old man, and it was a long time ago, and my memory could be failing, but I think Denny Walling was asking to be paid $35,000. That's what I remember. It could be that we settled at $35,000. Anyway, there wasn't a lot of money involved. He was going against the Houston Astros. And then maybe a week later, we did Joe Sandito, which was a bigger case. Joe was a star reliever, and he was, I think he filed for $210,000, and we won the case. So I think he got it. It was great for me because an arbitrator's view of a case is exactly the same as mine. I mean, my view of every argument was this side says that side says the other one. What are the facts here? And I pursued that question. What are the facts that would resolve this argument? I pursued that question 365 days a year. That was what I did and what I do. That's also how the arbitrator saw it. So I was living with a blizzard of petty objections that I couldn't really rebut at that time. And all of a sudden you get into what is in essence a courtroom, and everybody's trying to play my game all of a sudden. So that was just wonderful from my standpoint. I mean, it put everybody else in the position of being forced to look at the case the way that I looked at it all the time. So it was, I enjoyed it very much. I know it's becoming a long answer, but I quit working arbitration cases 10 years later because the numbers were just getting, from my standpoint, out of control. I mean, I remember I worked a case for a nice young man that I liked a lot, but he'd been in the league, I think, 3 years, and he was asking to be paid $4 million. And I thought, what do I care if this guy gets $4 million or not? You know, I mean, Denny Walling getting $35,000, I could relate to that. But I really didn't care whether this nice young man made $4 million or only three. So I just stopped working in those cases.
So the first time you mentioned about the contact with teams, because I'm sure based on my conversations I've had with baseball executives, they were certainly aware of your work. The first time that a club reached out to you just to sort of pick your brain, or some front office person that you ran into began to pick your brain about the numbers that you were generating.
Well, I don't run into a lot of people. I didn't go places where they were. I did later, of course, but as a young person, I didn't. I would have to say that it was that time in the early 80s where a team hired me to do a study of what would happen to their team if they moved their fences. They asked me not to reveal that I was doing that, and I still haven't mentioned the team, which, you know, it's been 37 years, and everybody involved in it is dead except me, so I wonder if I'm still bound by that promise, but I'm still honored.
Okay, well, I'll make my case to you. Bob Woodward, you know, once Deep Throat passed away, then he was okay with coming out with it. So, he felt like that was an agreement. So if I were to do my reporter thing and try to nudge you along, that would be my argument to you about that.
It's not a bad argument. I just hadn't thought about it.
What was the, without getting into the name of the team then, what was the specific part of the study of the ballpark that you were asked to do?
Well, they were thinking anyway about moving their fences deeper, and they had just signed a right-handed power hitter, and they were thinking about moving their left field fence back, and they thought, well, this doesn't make sense. Maybe we should see how these two will combine. My conclusion was, go ahead and do it. First of all, it's not going to decrease the run production of the park by all that much, because when you move the left field fence back, the left fielder has to play deeper and balls falling in front of him, and the net effect is not all that large, although there's some, but, you know, 15 feet is not going to make all that much difference. And second, okay, this power hitter is going to lose 3-4 home runs. That's really nothing against in the context of a team over a year. So I recommended that they do it, and they did it. Then they didn't win the pennant for 15 years after that, so I don't know if that had any effect or not.
What teams back then did you feel like were ahead of the curve? Maybe not necessarily going as far as you did in terms of looking at numbers, but there's the way they structured teams, the way they put together rosters, the way they put together lineups, you know, the investments on various players. Back then, what team did you feel like were ahead of the curve?
Well, the it's almost a cliche to say this because everybody who read my stuff will know. The Baltimore Orioles not only seemed to be ahead, but there's no question they were ahead. First of all, Earl Weaver's inherent sense of how to manage a team was very compatible with my idea. And second, the Orioles were a low budget operation, which was competing with teams that had a lot more money. So they had to be into Moneyball long before Moneyball was cool. So that's one. Also, I should mention that the Texas Rangers hired a friend of mine, Craig Wright, and he worked for them, having the title of sabermetrician, and I think he was hired in maybe 82. So that certainly has to be mentioned. Also, the Orioles hired the sabermetrician early on. But I should mention this also. I mean, Whitey Herzog did everything that – not everything. Whitey Herzog did a lot of things that were directly contradictory to what I was arguing. But that was a lesson for me because I could see that he really knew what he was doing and that he was highly successful and that there was a logic to it and a power to it that even though he wasn't doing the things that I might have suggested that he would do, nonetheless, he was very, very, very good manager. And that was an important lesson for me not to be too carried away with the significance of the things that I was arguing for.
I'm curious if you ever got a chance to talk to him about that. And it's interesting you say that because I remember, you know, being in high school when, you know, Daryl Porter was catching first for the Kansas City Royals. And then he goes to St. Louis, signs a free agent as soon as Whitey goes from the Royals to the Cardinals. And to me, like Daryl Porter was one of the first names where I think you could see the progressiveness and where the game was going and how walks were valued. And right. That was clearly someone who Whitey valued.
Right. Well, the 1981 Cardinals had a platoon combination of catcher. They had Porter and Gene Tennis. I mean, is that the most redundant platoon combination ever? Porter and Tennis were the same, right-hander and left-hander, but they were both catchers who were well past 30, and their best years were behind them. But they both hit 240, but walked a lot and hit home runs and ran the pitching staff well, threw pretty well, so they made an extremely effective combination. Although at that age, I'm not sure either one of them was still top flight. Well, I don't know. Whitey in his biography raves about how valuable Porter was to the team. So maybe I should suggest he was past his prime.
Whitey, did you ever get a chance to talk to him?
I have talked to him a few times, but I never tried to talk to him about my work. Other than once, I tried to squeeze in a question in a post-game conference one time about 78 when he still was at Royals, and he didn't take the question very well, so I never went back to it.
Do you remember what the question was or what the topic was?
I do, and I still think I was right about it, but Whitey thought it was a stupid question anyway. It was a game between the California Angels and the Royals in 78, and the Royals had rolled something like 7 singles through the infield in the course of the game. And that really struck me that, you know, you could have an infield that would just, the infield desperately lacked range. I mean, I don't remember who was playing what position for them, but the infielders were just too slow. And the pitching stats were awful. So I tried to ask him after the game, do you think that the giving up 7 singles through the infield in the game, is that a reflection on the defense making the pitching staff look bad? And he clearly thought it was not. He thought it was just a question that pitching was really bad because of giving up all those base hits. I still think I was right, but it's been a long time.
When did you start to you know, as someone who's doing the research and you're analyzing players, when did you start to feel like that your work and the respect for your work was starting to turn the corner in the sport?
I think I was slow to pick up on that. Well, I knew that I had an audience, and I discovered by 1982 that the audience I was writing to was a lot bigger than I had assumed that it was. You wouldn't believe later on how many old scouts would come up to me and say, you know, I was on your side way early. I was telling the Minnesota Twins to use your stuff in 1979. Or I would hear that a lot. And I don't think those guys were lying. I think they were telling the truth, but at the time they were awfully quiet about it. You know? You could tell just from the way that they were doing some things that the Oakland A's were listening. And by 1984, you could figure that out. And you really couldn't miss it. I mean, and that's before Billy, but that was Sandy Alderson's time. But you couldn't miss the fact that the Oakland A's in the mid-'80s were doing some things that were consistent with my ideas. Being a young person, you don't want to start, you know, claiming, oh, look, they're doing things my way. You know, you sound stupid doing that. I don't know. I wouldn't say that I really understood how wide-ranging ideas had become until I understood it once other people started ripping them off and publishing articles that were similar to mine.
Bill, this is a true story. When I graduated from high school, the gift that I got from my parents was a baseball abstract from 1982. That spring was the spring that I graduated, and that's when I really got into your work. And, you know, subsequently, Peter Gammons and I would talk a lot about it. You mentioned Sandy Alderson. Have you ever gotten a chance to have a conversation with him about all that?
No, I don't think I haven't. I definitely have not. I do not recall that I've ever met him other than saying hello to him in the hallway at the Twitter meetings. Otherwise, I don't think I've ever met him.
What about players in your time, working on baseball, just running across players have them been interested? Because it feels like in the last 5 years, that's taken a dramatic turn.
Right. Well, I think the players are interested in modern sabermetrics, a lot of which isn't really that connected to stuff that I did or stuff that I did. But I would say it was my experience that the players were always more receptive and were always more receptive to my ideas and had a less intellectual resistance to them than writers did. And there's no doubt about that. First of all, my earliest experiences with players was working with them in arbitration cases. For the first 7-8 years from 79 to 86 or thereabouts, I was working with players in arbitration cases. So we were on the same side. So they were predisposed to listen, but also just, to give you one example, the idea that one hitter protects another one and that whenever a good hitter is out of the lineup, the announcers will say, or reporters will say that this affects the hitter ahead of him. In my experience, very few players actually believe that. People who believe that are reporters, and reporters will say that and write that, but if you talk to players about it, they will say that, but it's sort of players have to acknowledge the significance of their teammates in their success, and they do so as part of the manners of the game and the form of the game, and they will include that in the sort of form of the game, but in terms of actually believing that the guy in the on-deck circle makes you a better hitter, my experience, very few players actually believe that. And I remember talking to, I shouldn't give names because I don't want to speak for players, you know. But I remember discovering that this actually wasn't that popular a theory among the players, probably by 86, 87.
What were you mentioned about the resistance from reporters? And I can definitely speak to that through the years, hearing that. What were some examples of that you experienced?
First of all, you have to understand that I was rude. I mean, I don't mean to, but before I had kids and had a kind of more adult view of the world, I was sort of a young troll, and I said a lot of stuff about players and about other writers. In retrospect, it was just not very friendly, you know. So I'm responsible for a lot of the things that came back at me. There's a lot of resistance to statistics, and there are a lot of people and a lot of reporters who hated math when they were in the fifth grade, and they hated math when they were in the eighth grade, and they hated math when they were in college, and they didn't understand why they had to do it. And they still hate math. And there is nothing that you can do about that. You know, you cannot change that fact. So those people, and I always had, I tried to write in such a way that you could get what I was saying without understanding the math. I tried to do that, but it's there, you know. So there was a lot of resistance to what I was saying based simply on the fact that there was math in it and people didn't like the math. If I reached for it, I could probably identify a couple of special instances of reporters who were especially hostile. I remember this guy who worked for the San Francisco Examiner who used to write tirades about how stupid I was. I can't remember what his name was. I tried not to personalize it, just go on with what I was doing.
When the book Moneyball came out, what was your reaction when you first read it? And at that time, could you have imagined that the impact that it would have on front offices and the structure of front offices and the number of people who are interested in working in baseball?
No, I couldn't have imagined it. I imagined it. I think I heard rumors that Michael Lewis was working on a book about my field. I'd read a couple of Michael Lewis books before that, so I knew he was a very good writer. And I heard rumors he was working on something in my field. And then he called me and said, I've been working on this book and I need to talk to you. He was near the end of the book by the time he called me. He said, I need to talk to you just so that when reporters ask me if I talked to you, I can say that I did. He didn't put it in those words, but I think that's what he meant. You know? And then he came out to Kansas and I spent a day and a half with him. So that was, I knew what the book was. In terms of reading the book beginning to end, you may not believe this, but I still have not read the damn thing beginning to end. I mean, I read portions of it, but I try never to read anything written about me. And that goes back to those earlier days when most of what was written about me was hostile, if not outright hateful. And I got in the habit of thinking, you know, if I read that, if it's good, it inflates my ego and makes me think I'm better than I am. If it's bad, it makes me angry and there's nothing I can do about it. In neither case does it really help me. So I don't read stuff written about me. I try actively not to read stuff written about me. For years I would pick up a baseball book in the bookstore and check the index, and if my name was in the index, I wouldn't buy the book. So I still have not read all Moneyball, and I certainly did not have any concept of the impact it would have on the culture.
Yeah, it's been absolutely dramatic. I was always curious when you worked with the Red Sox. I'm always curious about what you did with them, because I never saw that like fully defined in stories. And I was curious about different things that you would do and sort of the way that you would work with the front offices at that time.
Well, early on, I think I had some impact. For example, I would help them. Theo knew the sorts of things that I could do and couldn't do, and he was very good at asking me, what do you think of this? And I'd get a little report. One thing I did that caught on was I was asked to come up with a systematic way of classifying players for not just for salary purposes, but for comparison. You have words like superstar and star and potential star and all-star and veteran player and stuff, but I was asked to create an actual schematic in which we could say that this player is, what I came up with was he's an A1, meaning he's the best player in baseball at his position. He's an A2, meaning he's an all-star. He's a B1, meaning he's a quality regular, a guy who would be a regular on a championship-type team. A B2, meaning he's like a second-division regular. A C1, meaning he's like a bench player, a good bench player. And a C2 is like, you have to use this kind of guy sometimes because you don't like to. Proposed that to the Red Sox. They adopted it. They still use it now. In fact, it's spread and a lot of other teams use it now. It's a way of classifying players so that you you have a sort of a set of objective standards to know where a guy fits in that schematic. And you're not insulting him by saying he's a, you know, you can say, I think he's a C1. And you're not saying, I think he's a bench player, but it has the same impact. I developed a lot of things like that that became part of the language of the Red Sox, a part of the language of the game. And then I participated in discussions. We'd be arguing about who we sign and, you know, Theo's going to sign whoever he wants to sign, basically. I mean, he was awfully good at when an organization wants to sign a high-powered free agent, it inevitably becomes a kind of battle between people who want to invest you have limited shots to do that, right? You got a limited number of big-name free agents you can sign, and it always becomes the kind of battle of which one you want to do. Theo is awfully good at persuading ownership and scouts and everybody to go along with the guy he wants to sign. But I was part of that process for a few years.
How did you like that? Having been on the outside and sort of looking at front offices and their work from 30,000 feet to then being on the other side of it.
I loved it. I mean, it was a lot of, first of all, I got along great with scouts. What I discovered is that for the most part, scouts view of the world is the same as mine. We all know that we're being asked to do something that nobody can do. I mean, none of us can actually look at a young player and say where he's going to be in 4 years, but we all have to anyway. The scouts are basically guys like me. They're just kind of, you know, we didn't go to business school and we don't speak that language. And so we just love baseball and like to hang around baseball games. And, you know, they're mostly people just about like me, except for the math teacher. So I always got along great with scouts. I enjoyed participating in those discussions. I enjoyed winter meetings for a long time, except when they're in that god-awful hotel in Nashville. But I'm sorry, I hope they're not one of your sponsors.
No, but not at all. I just laughed. I was chuckling to myself. I went to school in Nashville, and so I know. And for years, of course, they had the winter meetings there so many times, and everybody would get lost all the time. But go ahead.
I loved everything about working with the Red Sox. It was very, the challenges were great, and the organization was great. And I never worried about anything. There was one time that I was taking a lot of heat for what people imagined was my idea of how to use the bullpen, although it actually wasn't. But anyway, I was taking a lot of heat for it. But I never worried about any of that stuff because I knew that this organization was going to succeed. I mean, from the day I got there, I could look around and I could see the intelligence and the energy and the goodwill of the people who were there. So I knew that they were going to win championships. I never had any doubt about that. And so I knew that, you know, this is all going to work out fine. So it was just a fun ride from my standpoint.
Yeah, I remember the story of Brian Cashman going to George Steinbrenner at the end of the 2005 season and talking about the Red Sox and saying, they are so far ahead of us and we need to get where they are. Like, we have to catch up because he saw the same things that you did. Last one before we go, I'm curious about this. It feels like that defense is the holy grail. Trying to measure defense is the holy grail that a lot of teams are trying to get to. And a lot of folks who do the work that you do have said to me, we're getting closer, but we don't really feel like we're there. Where do you see us in terms of being able to quantify defense?
Well, oddly enough, I'm in the middle of a long research project. That's what I'm doing during the pandemic. I'm hiding out here and working on a long defense research project. But you're right. I mean, we have made a lot of progress, and we understand it a lot better than we did 40 years ago. But, yeah, we're not quite there. And, you know, the real problem is, Buster, the real problem is that you can't objectively cross-check at things like you can in baseball. In baseball, you can say this player created this number of runs, right? And there are a lot of different ways to cross-check that. But in fielding, you can say this player saved that many runs or that player saved that many runs. And it's very, very hard to cross check it. So that's why the numbers just don't work that well for fielding or defense in any sport, but you're right that we're just not there yet.
All right, Bill. I really enjoyed this, a fun conversation. And again, I always feel like I got that connection with you. That was my high school graduation present, one of your abstracts. Thanks for taking the time and distract us a little bit.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Buster.
Callie McDaniel writes for ESPN and is the co-author of Future Value, The Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. And before we get to that, Kylie, yesterday we had met minor league baseball pushing back on the idea that their season has been canceled, you know, to the degree that the organization put out a statement last night. But you and I know the current situation is so fragile. And I was thinking back to March when there were initial reports out of London that the London series between the Cardinals and Cubs was going to be canceled, and Major League Baseball pushed back on that and said, no, we haven't officially canceled it. And then that came. And then earlier this week, Bob Nightingale, USA Today, had a story saying it looks like the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies is going to be canceled. And there was pushback, and it was like, no, we haven't officially canceled that yet. And yesterday we got word, yes, it is officially postponed. And I feel that way about the minor league season, that eventually we'll probably hear that announcement, because the fact is that on Major League Baseball's list of priorities, it's far down the list. And you would expect, as they try to make a push to have some sort of a major league season or tournament or whatever form it would take, that, you know, this is on the back burner. What do you think?
Yeah, it's one of those things that in talking to, you know, agents, executives, people like that for the last couple months, it's just been a foregone conclusion that it's gone from, you know, very unlikely that there will be a minor league season to in the last few weeks, it's been like, oh, there's a 0% chance. It's not going to happen. But I guess there just hasn't been the, you know, the formal announcement of anything yet. And I think similar things have happened with the draft, where it's been, you know, talked about for, you know, probably about a month now that it's going to be a certain day, a certain amount of rounds. And it's, you know, 90% sure. It just hasn't been formally announced yet. And on the minor league side, it just, you know, it sounds like there's going to be some version of, you get, you know, 30 to 50 or maybe 60 players, you know, inside your bubble to be a part of the season, and trying to do that for, you know, A ball and double A and all these different levels, when there's not that much money to be made, and they don't have an agreement. And there's just like so many different things going on. And like you're saying, it's so far down the list of things to try to get done, to have like a biodome in Rome, Georgia or something. It just sort of seems silly that they would, that would, you know, be something anybody would even try to do.
Yeah. I mean, the more people you have in a so-called biodome, the less likely it is that you can keep it going. And the priority is going to be the big leaguers, because they're the guys who would generate the revenue. And that's why I don't think baseball would extend it. You mentioned the draft. Where do we stand on that? And I've, you know, talked to club executives who talked about their teams running mock drafts and for trying to prepare in that way. What have you heard?
Yeah, it's another one of those things that the, you know, sort of initial day that it was going to be was June 10th. Once it was announced a little while ago that it could be as late as July 20th, it quickly became clear that MLB's intent was to have it on June 10th and have it be five rounds, unless something happened. Like the way it was explained to me was, if there's a bunch of, you know, amateur contests that they can, the teams can judge off of, then they'll be inclined to want to, increase the amount of rounds from 5 to 10. And that was basically, it was basically one of those two options. And I think part of the thinking was both more information, but also that would mean there's a better chance that there would be actual, major league games. So there'd be more cash flow. And obviously neither of those are happening. And so it just sounds like it's, you know, for weeks, it's been pretty clear it's going to land on June 10th and be five rounds. And my sort of last check in this morning, so I guess a little breaking news of 20 minutes ago, was that it is not completely official. But as of last night, like people that are, I guess, are in the know are sort of indicating that it sounds like they're sort of, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's and whatnot. So I think it may have been sort of decided in that they are moving in that direction, officially. But it is not like ready to announce all, everything has been finished yet, but it sure seems like that foregone conclusion, similar to the minor league season, is about to be sort of wrapped up.
So we touched last week on how everything going on could potentially have a huge effect in the scouting community, with a lot of folks being let go or furloughed and losing their jobs. And I thought about it that, you know, everything that's going on, while when you wrote your book, you weren't thinking about the coronavirus, but so many of the trends that you write about, those are, and so many of the shifts in the industry that you write about, they're going to be accelerated by the situation. Yes.
Yeah, that's something Eric and I have been staying in touch about, and obviously Jeff Passan and I as well, because it seems like the sort of trajectory of scouting is to have more remote stuff, more data. There's going to be more sort of StatCast and TrackMan and things like that available. And so that then means the role of the scout and the area scout specifically is lessened. There also has been a little bit of movement for MLB to sort of insert themselves and do some of the work for the team in terms of, you know, they've got this video scouting bureau. They used to have scouts. They've now started putting on events under the banner of PDP. So there's all these different ways that essentially the area scout is getting cut out of things, that they're less essential than they used to be. And also it's like, you know, people do not know, are not like blindsided by a third round pick that no one's ever heard of on draft day. It just doesn't happen anymore. And so it's just more of a process, that, anyone can sort of just be plugged in. Like you can hire an area scout right when the season starts and he'll do fine. So the thought was in the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, the amateur scouting staff, for the draft will go from, you know, 15 or 20 people when you add together all the cross checkers and scouts for any one team down to like 8 or 10. Because eventually it'll just be that they have StatCast in the SEC and the ACC. And so the idea of like having a scout fly in for one day of a Clemson LSU game, to say what he sees, well, you could have, you know, every inch of what's happening on the field for all 3 years of a guy at LSU's career. So him going in for one day, he can tell you some stuff. But flying in for one day seems pretty silly, even more than it does now. And so the thought is now with teams that were not inclined to go down that road or haven't started going down that road yet, they're going to involuntarily have a draft class where they are going to do more, you know, more data and less reports comparatively than they have in the past. And they either may like it, may like the way it goes, because a lot of these GMs that are making the picks like to be able to be a bigger part of the decision-making process, because now you're not going to have 20 scouts in the room. You might have 8 scouts in the room. And so maybe they just like that process if they think those 8 scouts are good enough. And they're also going to see like the cost savings would be very obvious when not as much travel and possibly not paying as many scouts. And so it just sounds like this whole exercise will speed up, that whether it's, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now, it might be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years from now, where amateur staffs, as an example, for all the different, you know, scouting staff sizes for both, you know, scouting minor league games, scouting internationally, things like that, will start, you know, getting smaller as a result, because teams will be a little more comfortable with it than they were before all this.
And of course, having fewer people and relying more on data, specifically, in your eyes, what are some of the most important data that's going to be relied on by these teams?
So for the college players, so this is unusually for this draft class, it's a usually good draft class overall. It's especially concentrated in sort of SEC, ACC, mostly track record players that you have reports going back to their junior year of high school up to junior year of college. You've got 4 years of data. And so you've got data on them from when they played at Area Codes in August before their senior year of high school. And then for a lot of these big schools, you've got 3 years of data, all through college. And a lot of times it's, you know, a guy like Tanner Burns at Auburn has been basically the same guy for the last 4 years. And so you feel pretty good. And he's made, you know, incremental improvements. But he was like a fringe first round pick out of high school, won a lot of money, didn't get it. And now is, you know, looks to be like a mid to late first rounder. And so with that guy, it's like comparing him to a high school righty. It's not just that he's 3 years further along and more polished. But you have so much data about, you know, what his arm slot, and what his, you know, spin rates and the shape of his pitches. And, obviously just some surface stats about, you know, strikeouts and walks in the SEC is sort of like the most important piece of information you can have for a pitcher, on the amateur side. I'd say the most important stuff, in terms of like trying to stand in for a scouting report, when you look at max exit velos, so if you get a big enough sample of exit velos for a hitter, that stands in for raw power, which gives you an idea of how much upside there is if you sort of believe your player development staff can sort of tap into it. That's probably one of the bigger ones. If you have a bigger sample, obviously, like, you know, average exit velo or contact rates are another big one. On the hitter side, for pitchers, teams are now sort of following, or have been for years following, the blueprint that Houston laid out of four-seam fastball, high spin, curveball with high spin, pairing those two together specifically. And so there's both guys that look like that now and sort of give you those characteristics, or that have like high spin, but they haven't optimized the spin axis. So there's adjustments that can be made, or they show high spin, but it's at a lower slot. So if you bring their arm slot up higher, all of these things are very obvious either, from looking at the TrackMan data, but you can also see guys that just like, it looks like they spin their curveball really well from a lower slot. Like a scout can see these things. But like I said, I mean, there are players that look like they might go in the second round where teams told me, oh, we didn't get out to see him this spring. Like he was in Florida. We know he was playing. We were going to see him the next week after all this stuff shut down. And so we don't feel as confident making that pick as other teams do. If that's a major college guy, everyone's going to feel confident making that pick. And so those guys are going to get moved up as a result of having all of this data.
What's a really cool anecdote that you dug out when you were researching the book that when you got it, you were fired up?
So one of the questions we had asked a bunch of scouts, there's, I don't know, 10 or 12 guys that are quoted in here that answered a bunch of questions for us. The one thing that I wanted to find that I wasn't sure I had, because a lot of these guys, like I heard their stories. And so I was able to prompt them and be like, hey, tell me about this story. And a lot of times there were little details in there that I didn't remember. Or I was able to find someone else that was on their staff that could sort of tell it to me from their perspective. But the question I wanted to get an answer to was, tell me about a time when you knew about a player who we now know is good before everybody else did. It was kind of a secret. And you found it before everybody else. And the one that I think that people have sort of been, you know, tweeting at me was like their favorite story from the book was about the Marlins discovering JT Realmuto. And the short version of it is their scouting director, Stan Meek, who, he, in the book, he talks about, you know, drafting Yelich and Stanton and Jose Fernandez and Realmuto. Like he's been around the block a few times picking these guys. Realmuto was a high school, primarily a football player, obviously played baseball as well. He knew from watching him play high school football on TV. He went out to see him for the first time in the spring, which is already like a little unusual these days. And he was catching by accident. He wasn't supposed to be catching. It was because there was an injury. And so his first time seeing him, he sees like all five tools flashed. He's catching, which he has literally never done before. And he is so impressed with him that he decides not only can me and my scout that are not here, we can't let any other teams know that we like this guy. We can't let the kid know, because if the kid knows how much we like him, he's going to want to go get an agent. His price is going to run up. He's going to start telling everybody else, hey, the Marlins really like me. And Stan, being from Oklahoma, has a long track record of finding guys in Oklahoma first. And so it's now those two scouts basically can't tell anyone. It's like, don't tell your wife, don't tell your kids, don't tell anyone else on staff. Like we have to get this guy, but we can't let anyone know we were here. And if we come back and see him again and another team comes in for the first time and sees Stan here, they're going to know that Stan loves him because he wouldn't come back again if he didn't. And so he's like, we can't come see him again either. Like this day has to stand for everything. And then we're just going to take him later. So there's a bunch more detail in there about like exactly how they sort of pull that off. But I've heard stories like that about players that ended up not making it. And it seems kind of silly in retrospect that you're like doing all of this like espionage level stuff to make sure no one knows that this guy that got released at A-ball doesn't get discovered. But when it's a big league all-star that's, you know, the best catcher in baseball, it's much more interesting, especially when it's Stan, you know, living 10 miles from the guy or whatever it ended up being. And he wasn't even sure this guy was a good player in the spring before he was going to get drafted. And, you know, we're talking about how, you know, guys are known before their springs and now teams are drafting them off of not even really getting a spring, especially for the players up north that didn't get started yet. And this is an example of sort of an era before that where it was possible to have a guy sort of hidden a little bit.
Why do you think that's more prevalent in baseball? Cause boy, I love those stories. I've got 1,000 of those stories of a guy I covered back in the minor leagues back in the day. Chris Hammond had a long career in the minors. He, you know, one day he wound up pitching when, to fill in, but he was woken up. He slept in late and a teammate scrambled to wake him up. He barely made the team bus. He winds up pitching in the game. And based on that performance that day, the Cincinnati Reds drafted him and he winds up having this long career. Why do you think it's more prevalent in baseball than in other sports?
I don't know. I mean, there's like a version of that with Jacob DeGrom too, where he was just like a college shortstop and then he just starts pitching. And then now you're watching him like in the big leagues, you're like, well, how was he ever not pitching? Like he looks like what a pitcher's supposed to look like. And you know, he was obviously like a sort of second tier shortstop for Stetson. It's not like he was, you know, setting the world on fire at that point. But yeah, I feel like every organization probably gets one of those every 3 or 4 years. I remember when I was with the Braves, they would always talk about Brandon Beachy. Like this is the reason we pay attention as scouts, is because this guy's going to throw 3 innings in college and you need to be there when it happens. And then, you know, that guy becomes a big leaguer. And, you know, Brandon Beachy wasn't like a huge difference maker, but I'm saying like every team has a guy like that gets the AAA or the big leagues and is like of note. and has a crazy story like that or some crazy scouting story. I worked for the Pirates the year that we took Josh Bell and signed him when literally every other team said he was unsignable. And that was also a result of like a scout, like doing his research. So yeah, I mean, it's a good motivator for young scouts to sort of explain to them, you know, why they need to like really stay on top of stuff. But yeah, I guess I can't hit all the different like little mechanisms involved for why it feels like we hear these stories more in baseball than other sports. But I guess having so many different positions and specialties and all that sort of stuff like probably helps that everybody gets thrown into one thing and then the other thing is so different that, you know, I feel like in football, if you're a safety or a linebacker, it's not like it's so different that you just discovered something when you suddenly stood 5 yards closer to the line of scrimmage.
What did you learn about the pursuit of players from Cuba and working on your book?
Yeah, it's as frustrating and confusing as I thought it was. And it's not like, you know, a dig at like the country or the players, obviously, but I guess the thing that was like most explained to me in like a complete way that I hadn't been explained to me before was all of the different sort of like cultural and social elements that the players have to overcome, which like I knew them like inherently. If you asked me each question, I'd be like, oh yeah, they have to do that. But like the, you know, sometimes you'll read a report that I'll write and it'll be like, you know, this Cuban player, you know, defected and then he signs for $5 million and then he'll, you know, start an A ball this year and he wasn't very good because he hadn't played in a while. And it's like, just like try to imagine that you're like an amazing baseball player. And then in order to sort of move up a level and get paid and all of these like, you know, dreamlike things to happen to you, you have to get a drug dealer to drive you on a boat away from your family, knowing you may never see them again. You may get killed on this boat. You may be, if you're Yasiel Puig or some other players, you may get held by drug dealers as like ransom, like you're a piece of meat. And then you have to have this like super high stakes workout. You have to get in crazy shape, you know, having all the different sort of like workout food and elements and things like that you've never had before, you know, sort of being in a communist state. And then you have to be in a country where the weather and the social elements and the language and everything is completely different. And you might have to spend 3 or 4 years in the minor leagues to then figure out what's going on. And then when you sort of emerge from that, like if you have like a, you know, a weak start to the big leagues, you just get like booed at some guy that's not very good. And it's like that process, while, you know, there's like sort of money and, you know, sort of the end of the rainbow is there. If you're just like a kid from suburban Atlanta that, you know, plays travel ball nonstop, like there's some ups and downs and roller coaster elements to that. But when you throw all of the sort of Cuba stuff on top of it, it's like, yeah, sometimes, you know, you see a list of players and there's like 32 Americans and 28 Dominicans and like 15 Venezuelan players and 2 Cubans. You don't always sort of do the math of what the sort of personal elements are of each player, because it's just a list of players and this is, you know, the 40-man roster for this team or whatever. But yeah, I guess it sort of drilled down in my head a little bit more. Like this is the exact circumstances that almost every single one of these players is going through. And it's, you know, it's just sort of, I don't want to say silly because it minimizes it, but it's just sort of insane that they all have to go through this when it can be so easy comparatively for other players domestically.
Yeah, and there have been some big hits, great hits from, you know, great players that came out of Cuba. You know, Yasiel Puig, you mentioned, you know, Jose Abreu. And then, you know, and when I covered the Yankees, El Duque, Orlando Hernandez, and then it does feel like there are a lot of big misses. There was a player that the Yankees signed at that time. He was an infielder named Andy Morales. And I think they gave him about $2 million. $2.1 million is the number that sticks in my head. And I remember hearing from the coaches, like the first time he showed up at a workout and they're watching him going, what? Like, I mean, it was immediate, the reaction of club staffers, and he never panned out. But it feels like there are a lot of big misses coming because of the uncertainty that you're talking about.
Yeah, no, there was, I remember when I was with the Braves, I was, you know, sort of in the office, like working in like every department and also none of the departments. And so you'd have conversations with the, you know, the guy running international scouting, and he would mention like, oh yeah, like we just saw a Cuban guy for the first time today. We liked him. We'll kind of follow up. And you check back in like 2 months later, he's like, oh yeah, that guy was terrible. It turns out he's 8 years older than he said he was. And he was on steroids and like all the worst thing you can imagine. And then there was one story that it's not in the book, but there was one story I remember getting told where it was like, yeah, we just saw this guy. Like he had just defected. He gave us like, you know, a private workout and we are really excited. He sort of explains a couple of points about the player. I was like, that sounds pretty good. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, I forgot what his name is, but you know, I'll give it to you later when I remember it. And it turned out it was Yordan Alvarez. And it was like the first like workout that one of our guys saw. It was almost exactly what he is in the big leagues. It was, you know, it was like, oh, I'm not sure he can play defense, but he's got huge power and a beautiful swing and, you know, great body and everything's so smooth. But you hear that level of, he looks really good, we'll see what happens, about like almost every player that comes over, like of note, that, you know, signs for a couple million dollars. They all look like that at some point. And there's just like so many different directions they can go, like so abruptly. Like if you think it's tough, like, you know, scouting 14 to 15 year old players to, you know, lock them up to deals and sign them at 16 and then they go in so many different directions. Like if there's just like the amount of variance and mystery and like you don't know the track record, like even just like on a basic level, teams want to be able to do a background check to make sure that all the information is correct, but they can't go into Cuba to do the background check. So you just kind of have to take their word for it. And a lot of times, like the most like sort of, you know, what's your birthday like background check a lot of times is look them in the face and see if they look that age and then go to the old rosters that Cuba provided when they did international competitions and see what the date of birth was on there. And like beyond that, you can't really do anything else.
Look, being an author of a book when it comes out is a stressful time and you are working in a situation for which there's no handbook. Tell me the ways you're promoting your book.
It was a little bit of a letdown, obviously, for a number of reasons that everyone's, you know, working from home. And so many people are losing their jobs and, you know, so many terrible things are happening around the world. And there were some things planned where, you know, sort of been, you know, on camera ish type things, whether it's, you know, local TV or, you know, some of those radio shows that are, you know, on TV that sort of were on the table and are now off the table. But I think, for Eric and I, there's been just like a lot of, you know, podcasts, radio shows, there's been some sort of like Zoom conferences sort of about this stuff, and other sort of, you know, instead of, you know, going to a bookstore and reading it, you can do like sort of a virtual thing, through the, social media for the publisher or the bookstore, things like that. So obviously I think the plan was for Eric and I to be at a lot of high school and college games and then set up events around those. And, you know, sort of have our travel help out this process. And that hasn't happened. But, oh, boy, you know, I'm very happy to be on your podcast. I've been on a lot of podcasts that are much less professionally produced. So kudos to you. So, yeah, I don't think I guess somewhat luckily, Erica and I are not on going to Tonight Show and talk to Jimmy Fallon about our book to where like a bunch of, you know, great promotion is now off the table. It was just sort of like adjusting, I guess, in slightly different ways and trying to be, you know, every time there's some sort of news in baseball, try to position myself with local radio stations as, yeah, I can come and talk about that as long as we can talk about the book and try not to be quite as annoying as I think some people could be in that situation.
Well, I mean, with people at home, Starve for Baseball, this is a great way to get it. Again, the name of the book is Future Value, The Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. Kylie, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And, you know, thanks for helping out since I came on to ESPN and giving the book some time.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. CrossFit School of Sweat writes in, and school has been watching a lot of these old games here. He writes in, 70s and 80s versus 2000s. Big difference I noticed is the time from a ball in play, hit or out, until the next pitch thrown. Besides the length of time between pitches, is this another reason for longer games? Let's move quicker along when they get playing again. What do you think the reason for that is?
Because everyone just expects a new ball because they have learned how a marked up ball can be altered. Its trajectory can be altered in aerodynamics because it has a substance on a surface. And so in the past, if you fouled off a ball, the catcher would pick it up. He'd throw it back out to the pitcher and that potentially is going to move differently. And so I understand the perspective of the hitters. I understand why pitchers, you know, would love to use marked up balls. I would agree with you, school, that it is a big difference. There's no doubt when you watch those old games, you see the pace very, very much quicker. And I do hope we get back to that.
Last one for today. Reggie Deal at Baseball Nerd 07 writes in, why won't the Rockies bring in the fences a good bit at Coors? A few more homers will get out, but I contend that park is so offensive because so many ordinary fly balls find green landing space that would need five outfielders to cover it, which is funny that Reggie brings this up because we talked to Bill James about his study for an unnamed team about moving a fence.
Yeah, exactly. The way you pronounce that word too, offensive.
Offensive.
I do think
people
do find it because there's a lot of offense and that it is so offensive. Certainly pitchers felt that way. Look, you'd pick your poison. If you bring the fences in, then you'd have a ton more home runs. And so I think given the choice between these absurd games where you had, you know, 12 to 14 home runs on a regular basis, They move the fences back. You're 100% right. The reason why there's a lot of offense, well, the primary reason is because it's at elevation and the ball's just going to travel differently. And so I think the Rockies chose a product where it didn't become home run derby every night, which I would agree with that. But your point is well taken, Reggie.
That'll do it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Get at us.
That's it for today. My thanks to Kylie McDaniel, to Bill James, and to Taylor Schwenk, producing from his house in Connecticut. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.